a new type of T-cell and type 1 diabetes.
Omega-3 fatty acids for managing high triglycerides.
Blood pressure in midlife and changes in the brain.
And can we successfully restrict antibiotics in community hospitals?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on August 30th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to toss the ball right to you and turn to circulation, the Journal of the American Heart Association. This ongoing debate, oh my goodness, do those omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils, have anything to do with health whatsoever?
Well, Elizabeth, this is nice because they're revisiting this after over 15 years when they first issued their statement in 2002 looking at omega-3 fatty acids. And I'll remind our listeners, there's two they focus on. One is called eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA, and the other is docosahexaenoic acid, or DHA. Before, there really wasn't any clear path of whether they were useful or not. We know they decreased triglycerides. We just didn't know whether that was useful or not. They reviewed the latest literature, primarily focused on prescription omega-3 fatty acids. And they divided people into very high triglycerides, over 500, those that are just between 250 and 500, and below 250 is considered to be normal. And what they discovered was, for individuals that have very high triglycerides, over 500, omega-3 fatty acids decrease triglycerides by about 30%. In the group with triglycerides between 250 and 500, the use of omega-3 fatty acids decreases triglycerides by about 20 to 30%. In these individuals, it decreases the risk of cardiovascular events by 25% as well. That's specifically EPA. Now, there's an ongoing study looking at the combination of EPA and DHA. Those results won't be available till 2020. They're talking about taking 4 grams of these prescription omega-3 fatty acids to attain those results.
What are you thinking about this? In the overall scheme of things, we certainly have talked a lot about this prescription product that's available. I'm wondering about the cost-benefit analysis relative to that. And where do omega-3s fit with the dietary versus the supplement kind of an intervention?
First of all, they recommend that people look at their lifestyle and other medicines that could be causing hypertriglyceridemia. So for lifestyle, things that contribute are obesity, uncontrolled diabetes, excess alcohol consumption, and hypothyroidism. Medications that can increase triglycerides, things like oral estrogens and tamoxifen and steroids and beta blockers and loop diuretics, and even some of the treatment for HIV. Then, if that doesn't change the triglycerides, if they still remain elevated, then using these medications, and they're pretty cost effective because they're not very expensive, first of all. Secondly, they have very few side effects. So in terms of the cost-benefit analysis, I'd say, even though this study doesn't address it, it's got to be pretty favorable.
Okay. Let's turn from here across the pond to the European journal that focuses on diabetes, Diabetologia. This is a look at a new type of peripheral T helper cell, and I just find this fascinating. It feels like I've been talking a lot about newly identified types of T cells that nobody ever quite looked at before, and I especially think this one is pretty amazing. It's a subset of helper Ts, the CXC motif chemokine receptor type 5 negative programmed cell death protein 1 positive. Yikes, peripheral helper T cell. Okay, that's got a whole acronym, but I'm not even going to go through that. So in this study, they took a look at 44 kids with newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes, 40 who had autoantibody positive status and were therefore at risk to develop type 1 diabetes, and 84 autoantibody negative healthy control children. And they took a look at these particular circulating T helper cells and said, what's their role in the development of frank type 1 diabetes? What they found was that they were associated, when they found these things, with progression to clinical type 1 diabetes. And they say, gosh, these could be used both as a biomarker of disease progression and a target for trying to intervene in folks who were at risk to develop them. They think that they are supporting B cell responses in inflammation, and this could be the mechanism by which they're involved in the development of frank type 1 diabetes. They also note that they've seen that this particular cell has been identified in rheumatoid arthritis in the past, but this is the first time that any relationship with type 1 diabetes has been identified.
We've known about the T cells that live in the lymph tissue. That's called the CXCR5 positive, or the follicular T cells. The one you're describing is one that circulates. And in fact, what may happen is it may accumulate in the pancreatic tissue next to the B cells that facilitate the production of the antibodies. And if so, as you suggest, this may be a target. How would we prevent type 1 diabetes? Well, we identify individuals that have the antibodies and at that point begin to decrease T helper cell populations. And hopefully would get rid of the antibodies and hopefully either delay or reduce the risk of diabetes.
And of course, one of the big issues is how do we identify the people we're going to test?
We know that there are certain genetic predispositions. So that'd be one place to start. Once autoantibodies begin to be detected, maybe at that point, we give therapies to decrease the T helper cells.
Let's turn to yours. That's taking a look at antibiotic stewardship. That's in JAMA Network Open. And can we do this in community hospitals? We're already doing this in other hospitals.
Well, Elizabeth, you say we're doing it in other hospitals, and that's because most of the studies that have looked at antibiotic stewardship, either A, making sure people receive antibiotics that need them and the right ones, and secondly is that we shorten the amount of time someone's on antibiotics to as short as possible. All those studies have been done in large hospitals, primarily academic medical centers. But most of the U.S. population doesn't receive their care in the large academic medical centers. They receive it in the over 3,000 community hospitals scattered throughout the U.S. So the real question is, the things we've discovered in these large academic medical centers, can they be feasibly executed in the community hospitals? And that's what this study did. They looked at four community hospitals to see where they could implement two things. The first was called pre-authorization. Before an antibiotic could be distributed, you had to call up the pharmacist, and the pharmacist had to okay it. Secondly, was to do what's called a post-prescription audit and review. The pharmacist would engage the prescriber about the antibiotic appropriateness after the patient had been on it for 72 hours. In looking at about 2,700 patients, the interventions took about 95 days to implement. Where they had real problems is with the pre-authorization. The physicians were just reluctant to give that up. So the hospital did what's called a modified pre-authorization. They let the doctor give the first dose, and then after that, the pharmacist would give a thumbs up or thumbs down about whether to continue it. The post-prescription review was successful, and in about 40% of those patients, the antibiotic was modified in some way. So this tells us that pre-authorization, it ain't likely to happen in the community hospitals, but the review afterwards, it's more likely to happen, and it can be one aspect of antibiotic stewardship.
Is that really adequate for the overuse issue we have?
It's not ideal. It certainly is a step in the right direction. Being ideal isn't really helpful if you can't do it.
And you're such a pragmatic guy, and I applaud you for that. And of course, I'm such an idealist that I'd like to see a really good, effective, and comprehensive strategy implemented off the get-go based on rationality.
Well, you know, and part of this, Elizabeth, is in these small rural community hospitals is not having an adequate number of infectious disease people that you trust to give you a good opinion or not.
Well, maybe we can address that with telemedicine.
That may be a feasible thing to study, and that is, can pre-authorization with telemedicine address that issue? That's interesting. Let's look to see if we see that in the future.
Okay. Finally, then, let's turn to our last one for this week. It's in the Lancet Neurology. This is taking a look at the association between blood pressure across adulthood and late-life brain structure and pathology. They have this very interesting cohort called the 1946 British Birth Cohort, and they've been following these folks since 1946. They were enrolled, almost 5,400 of them, born throughout mainland Britain in 1 week in 1946, and they've been followed all the way along since then. They've had blood pressure measurements collected at ages 36, 43, 53, between 60 and 64, and finally at age 69 years. And they also calculated blood pressure change variables between these ages. In addition, they did all kinds of amazing things with regard to imaging. They measured white matter hyperintensity volume with MRI. They looked at beta amyloid positivity or negativity, whole brain and hippocampal volumes. And they administered cognitive testing and created a composite cognitive score. They looked at basically associations between blood pressure and blood pressure changes over all of those ages and what they saw using the imaging and the cognitive scores and said, all right, what do we see here? And what they see is that, sure enough, there are changes that are associated with blood pressure. And interestingly, it looks like higher diastolic blood pressure at 43 years of age was associated with smaller whole brain volume. And greater increases in systolic blood pressure early in life were associated with smaller hippocampal volumes. We know, of course, the hippocampus involved in memory formation. They didn't see anything that was relative to the amyloid beta status. So I thought that was really interesting, or the cognitive testing scores. And they conclude, okay, there are changes that happen to the brain as a result of these changes in blood pressure early in life, not necessarily Alzheimer's pathology, but maybe we ought to start looking at blood pressure monitoring around 40 years of age so that we can say, we're going to maximize your late life brain health.
Elizabeth, as you suggested, this is fascinating. Everybody enrolled in 1946, and now they're about age 70. What this study does, it kind of addresses the window of opportunity for trying to prevent dementia that's related to blood pressure.
Of course, this is very consistent with so many of the things we've been talking about with regard to blood pressure, along with things like ambulatory blood pressures measured over at least 24 hours and different time points, and also the impact of diastolic blood pressure.
Yep. As you noted, the diastolic blood pressure, at least early on, was a little bit more predictive than systolic, but both of them end up being important. And what happens as we age, our diastolic pressure usually goes down, our systolic pressure goes up. But if either one of them is elevated, we need to address it. And particularly now, it looks like in middle age, because these middle-aged blood pressure changes seem to contribute to late-life brain health.
I, for one, would like to see one more piece of data with regard to this relationship, and that would be BMI. Because I would like to know, what's the relationship of increasing body weight with the development of these different blood pressures, rather than intervene with regard to putting people on antihypertensives? I'd sure like to see a program of physical activity and weight loss.
I think we both agree that increasing BMI is associated with an increased risk of hypertension, and controlling the hypertension is the most important thing. We'd like to do it by lifestyle changes first and diet. We know both of those things can lower blood pressure. But if that's not successful, we would both agree that lowering it pharmacologically is important.
On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.